You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
Welcome to the School of Influence podcast, where the queen and king of influencer marketing, authors and professors Amanda Russell and Neil Schaefer, cut through the noise and dissect what makes brands and professionals influential. No fluff, just the real deal.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the School of Influence podcast. As always, today we have another special guest, a true influencer in the business world, and really the head of a company that has really revolutionized, in many ways, the way that we buy one of the most important things in our life. I know that I've been a customer there, and I've experienced that customer experience. We're going to talk a lot about that and the influence of business today. Amanda, I'll hand it over to you for the introduction.
Thank you. Yes, we are very excited to have Austin Ligon here with us today, who is one of the founders of CarMax. And now I don't even know where I would actually prefer you to tell a little bit about what you do today, but you're an angel investor in several different companies. When it comes to change, making change in business, you're probably one of the best people we could possibly talk to today. So I'm really excited to hear a little bit more about your journey. If you want to give us a little bit of the way of the land of what you're doing now since CarMax.
Sure. So I helped come up with the CarMax idea back in 1991, was co-founder of the company when we launched it in 93, and ran the company as president and CEO till I retired in late 2006. Since then, I've been an early stage seed investor and angel investor. And people always ask me, well, how that's going? And I say it's only been 14 years. I don't know yet. Because when you invest at the seed or early stage, I mean, literally you're, if not the very first money that an entrepreneur gets in the very first round or two, when business plans and all of that are pure fantasy, you know, you might as well read a Spider-Man comic book as a business plan of an early stage business. What you're judging is how capable is this person? Is the fundamental idea sound? So I make about one investment a year. I'm like Warren Buffett. I think if I find one good thing a year, that's a great year. And I don't actually go look for them. They look for me. People come to me and they say, well, you know, my business is not really like CarMax, but it's more like CarMax than anything else. We'd like you to be an advisor, you know, da, da, da. I don't do consulting because that's real work. And I've been a consultant, and A, people expect you to work a lot. And if I wanted to work, I'd still be working. And B, I'm have a very high opinion of myself. I would charge you a lot of money, like $100,000 a day, and then you'd want work, you know, and I don't do work. So what I figured out is if I tell people I want to invest in your company and I'd like to invest at least 1% so that if things work out, you know, I'll do pretty well. And over 8, 10, 12 companies, my most successful investment so far has been Redfin, where I was a pretty early investor. That's, you know, a successful public company now. I've got a couple of others that have done well. I have four that have gone out of business. And, you know, I can wax poetic on why. All were great businesses that made a few wrong decisions and ran out of money is what it boils down to. And so you learn that just because you have a better mousetrap doesn't mean you'll survive to have it in a form that it can either generate more capital or generate additional investment. So been a great learning experience. What I like about early stage investment is I served on a couple of public boards, which will go unnamed other than CarMax. And because I only like entrepreneurial businesses, I thought, well, I'll do more entrepreneurial businesses. What you learn is once an entrepreneurial business is public, a CEO has survived all of the trials and tribulations. They don't really want a board. The last thing they think they needed is advice. You know, I got this company to be a public company. I don't need advice. And frankly, that's often how I felt as several members of my board complained. And what I've learned is early stage companies, they actually do need advice. They want advice and you can be helpful to them. So they're a lot more fun to work with. I get to work with people in their 20s and 30s and early 40s, rather than old guys like me who often have lots of war stories and opinions, but you don't learn much from each other. So I like doing that because it forces me to continue to learn new things that have happened since, you know, I was actively running a company. So anyway, that's what I'm doing.
Wow. You know, there's so many different questions that I could, I'm trying to debate between like CarMax and investing, but I think one of the things that comes to mind, and Neil, you could maybe back it up, you know, add to this, but is immediately when you say an angel investor or, you know, an investor, and you've got companies that have failed and companies that have succeeded, what are the things or what is it that has influenced you? Because I think that every entrepreneur would love to have an investor like you. So what is it about their, is it the person? Is it the pit? Is it the pitch deck? Is it the idea? Is it a combination? Are you investing more in the that you think that this team of people is going to be successful? Or are you investing more in the idea? Or what, like, what are the thing or things that influence you to say, yes, this is the one?
I'm sure I've seen pitch decks. I don't really pay attention to them. I'm not one of these guys like a lot of VCs who read 1,000 pitch decks. It's always the person and the idea. So why do I only make one investment a year? The realm of my ignorance is so expansive that it's hard to measure. And there are very few things I know much about. And if you think about early stage investing, you need to have some expertise that gives you some insight that other people might not have, or it makes no sense. So me investing in biotech or solar energy or pharmaceuticals, I don't know anything about those. What I know about is consumer-oriented businesses that are geographically distributed. So people are spread all over the country. So they have a complex operational model where you have to figure out, how do you manage people who aren't there in the office with you every day, who aren't right at hand, and a complex operational execution? But in today's world, and this is what CarMax evolved to, their primary method for reaching the consumer is online. And I call those hybrid businesses. And so Redfin is a hybrid business because Redfin is both the best place to go for information on real estate. I've heard there are other places. Somebody told me something called Zillow exists, but I don't really know if they're any good. But Redfin is better. But Redfin has their own brokers spread throughout the country that work for Redfin, and they are essentially the CarMax of real estate. So I had no desire to be on a board in Seattle, Washington. I have no reason to go to Seattle. It's way out of my path of other things I do. I was based in Austin and Charlottesville at the time. But the idea was so compelling, I had to go meet the founder. And when I met the founder, he's just an incredibly bright bundle of energy, Berkeley English major who ended up in the software business. And you would say, well, that's odd. And what it tells you is, this is a really smart guy. You know, this is not your average English major. This is a really smart guy and driven, thoughtful, and what the English call a polymath, really able to conquer a whole variety of fields. And so ultimately, every investment, I think, is the person. And then you learn very quickly the team that they've brought together. And you want to meet the two or three people that they've got with them. And if the idea is no good, you're not going to invest in it anyway. But just because the idea is good is no indicator at all that it will be a successful business, because what you have to have in the person is someone who can adjust as the world throws them curveballs. Because if the world did nothing but throw strikes right down the middle of the plate, anybody could be an entrepreneur and you'd be able to do a pitch deck and it would come out that way. They throw curveballs, sliders, knuckleballs, you know, and change up pitches. They cheat. You know, big companies come in and try to crush you. And so the question is, how good is management at figuring out, okay, the world is not exactly as we thought it was. We need to pivot a little bit in what we're doing. Do they recognize that early enough while they still have the money to do it? And do they move with, I think the term is alacrity. Do they move fast? Do they, once they decide to move, they move fast and get it done. And that's really challenging because, you know, you're going 100 miles an hour through the fog and you see a little glimpse of what you think is down the road and you have to decide, do I turn left? And the people who turn out to be great entrepreneurs are the people who turn out to be willing, good at looking through the fog, willing to make that turn when they have to make it. They don't wait too late and go off the road and inspire confidence by making two or three or four of those turns. So you start to say, you know, that wasn't just luck back there. This guy actually knows, he and his team know what they're doing, and they're the right kind of people to survive the entrepreneurial challenge. Because as any entrepreneur will tell you, the word they've heard most in their lives is no. No, it'll never work. No, it's a bad idea. No, it's been tried before. And if that deters you, you'll never succeed. But if you're hallucinatory in what you want to achieve, you won't succeed either. And it's the person who can negotiate those two that is ultimately what you're investing in.
So do you think that this was something, like having been an entrepreneur yourself and built a company from the ground up and kind of gone through it, do you think that this is something that is learned, or that it's genetic traits, or do you think it's a combination of them both, or do you think it depends on the context?
So if you know who Walter Isaacson is, the guy who wrote the book on Einstein, and so Steve Jobs went to him and said, you got to write on me. He wrote a book called The Innovators, and his point in The Innovators is no person builds a company. He did sort of point to Steve Jobs, but the point was, look, Steve Jobs didn't build Apple any more than a single person built anything else. It's always a team. The thing you've got to be trying to understand is how good a team can they build and how well can the team respond. And I do think that I've developed some ability to understand how good is somebody at building a team and to evaluate how good their team is. And part of that is through painful experience of my own, all the mistakes I made, and through painful experience of some investments where, you know, I like somebody, but they're just not the right kind of person. So being an entrepreneur is helpful, but it doesn't give you another term I'm not a big fan of. There are a few of these, but there's a term out there called serial entrepreneurs, guys who've started 20 businesses. And
do you consider yourself a serial entrepreneur? Because I feel like a lot of people that say that are investors at that stage after they've been.
Yeah, no, I'm an investor. Now, a serial entrepreneur is somebody who starts more than one company. The number of people who started more than one successful company is infinitesimally small, and starts with Elon Musk and not many others, because the pain and suffering to succeed once and the numbers of times you have to be lucky. I always say, if you can't point out the five times that luck saved you, I mean, you had a great idea, a great team, everything else, but there were five times that you were just lucky and you survived and the other guy didn't. And if you can't point to those, then you have not honestly and objectively reviewed why you're here. And doing that twice is rare. Now, it does happen, but most serial entrepreneurs are guys who've started either a lot of baby businesses that they sell or a lot of businesses that didn't work. My goal certainly was never to be a serial entrepreneur. It was to start one company that could be a national, large company that would last 20, 30, 40 years and really scale up to dominate its arena. And that's the kind of entrepreneur I invest in. That's the kind of business I invest in. Folks who want to start something, grow it to $100 million and sell it. I've heard many VCs say that's really the business we're in. We're in the business of growing small companies to sell to big companies. And that's okay if you want to do that, but I have no interest in that. What I'm interested in is helping entrepreneurs grow businesses that either create or dominate a market arena. And that's where all the fun is, to see something go from $300,000 to $30 billion. And, you know, from literally five people in a room to tens of thousands of people spread all over the country. And that's a real, you know, somebody has really accomplished something if they've done that. But other than Elon Musk, who is insanely brilliant and insane, there's just not a whole lot of people who've actually built more than one successful company.
Yeah, Austin, I want to get back to the point you were talking about, being able to judge the success of a business by being able to pivot in bad times.
Yeah.
How do you, and I think that those businesses and people, influencers that have been able to last through all the changes in society have been able to successfully pivot. How do you judge that for a entrepreneur that has yet to experience bad things yet? Is there a way you can see the future?
So that goes back to team. I mean, the reality is, one of the things you'd love to have, there are some people you ask, you know, is it, you asked me before and I didn't really answer, is it genetic? Is it learned? And the answer is yes, all of those. But there are some people, and you know them, they simply have the personal energy and drive. As I had a venture capitalist for a professor at Yale MBA program, and he said, let me tell you two things about entrepreneurs. He said, first, an entrepreneur is the person who has hit his head into a wall 299 times and is 100% certain that the 300th time is the time I'm going to drive through the wall. And the second is, and pardon my French on this, I'll modify it slightly. An entrepreneur is the guy that you invite home for dinner, and when he leaves, your wife says, if you ever have that son of a gun in my house again, I'm divorcing you. Because the personality traits that make them able to achieve what they achieve are not actually very sociable traits. I mean, they're people who believe they are right and will drive through. But if they don't have a team, including some folks who've been there and done that before, I mean, if it's all newbies who've never done anything, they better have an awfully genius idea and be just at the right time. You know, I mean, a Facebook does come along every once in a blue moon, but 99% of the successful businesses aren't a Facebook or an Instagram. And you look at the average entrepreneur is in his early 40s. His team is that age or even a little bit older, and they've, you know, worked for 15 or 20 years and have a broad range of experience. So the first thing you're looking for is, does, if the guy who's driving this is young and insanely driven, is there anybody else on the team who's got some experience that may help them and advise them? And do they listen to them? You know, and so what you really love to see is a team that is cohesive. There's no politics. They work together. They change. Somebody says, okay, Joe, you need to go do this. You need to go from being head of marketing to go be head of finance because that's what your skills are best for right now. Or you need to step down a level and let somebody else do this job because you're really good. And rather than Joe saying, I quit, I'm going to Google, Joe says, I understand that. That makes a lot of sense because it's good for the team. Now, it helps if Joe's got 2 or 3 or 4% of the company so that Joe's, if it succeeds, Joe's, you know, going to be flying around the country in his own jet. So one of the things that a good entrepreneur does is make sure everybody on the team has enough of a stake that it's worth it for them to set their ego aside when they need to for the good of the business. And I think when you really know you've got a great team is when you see some of those characteristics early on. The other thing is, if I knew the answer to that, I'd be 12 out of 12. You know?
Of course, yeah.
I mean, all four of the businesses that went away had great entrepreneurs to start with, but they were not the person to take the business to the next stage. They waited too long to make a turn. They ran out of money and they ran out of confidence. In one case, I mean, we'd been through 8 rounds of funding. The VC was ready to put more in, but his partner said, hey, this is enough. You've come to us like 5 times. And I know you tell us each time we're right there. We're about to start making money. And it's like, yeah, you know, that's a great story. And maybe it's true this time, but, you know, we're just not buying it anymore of it. And you want to put your money in, that's fine. And that's not what VCs do. You know, they manage other people's money. In my case, it was my money, but I didn't want to put any more in either. But it was tragic because we, at that time, had changed. We had the right team, but we waited too late. So I would say that was our fault. And I would say, in fact, all four of the businesses that went away, it wasn't really the entrepreneur's fault. They were good at what they did and good at the phase they were in. But the one thing an early stage board does need to be prepared to do is when the person is not the right person for the next phase, help them understand that. Usually, they'll do really well financially. I mean, there are all sorts of foundations out there, multi-billion-dollar foundations run by guys you never heard of who were early parts of some business and turned out not to be the right person. And somebody made the right decision to say, look, you need to step aside, but your 2 or 3% is going to treat you fine. Those are the hardest decisions to make because you're often, you know, nobody wants to believe that about themselves. Everybody wants to believe that they're the right person and that, you know, this is their baby. And I'm a big believer in trying to find entrepreneurs who can take the business through the whole stage because people who are willing to make the crazy decisions. I mean, if the board is making the decisions, it's not a very good company. And it really, the thing you're identifying is reticence, when what you need to do is be aggressive and you're being reticent. I mean, somebody who's overly aggressive usually goes out of business very quickly, but it's somebody who's reluctant to make a decision when they need to make it, who turns out to be not the right person in the early stages.
Thank you. That makes a lot of sense. So to switch gears a little bit, I wanted to talk to you because this is actually how we connected, was over this program at the University of Texas called Tower Fellow. And I have been lucky enough to meet one of the Tower Fellows who actually put me in connection with you, and have been just blown away by the program, the quality, the caliber of people. I mean, talk about influence. It's a program designed for people that have been incredibly influential in their career paths, incredibly successful. Can you tell us a little bit about that and like why you decided to do this? Especially because I'm just going to recall the fact that you don't want to work anymore. And I know that this program can be a lot of work.
The answer is I have spent a lot of time in Palo Alto because I have a son who lives there and works there. And I was aware of the Stanford program called the Distinguished Careers Institute. And I actually looked into it, and they were kind of full for the next year. And then somebody at UT called me and said, you know, we're setting up a program called Tower Fellows. And it's actually modeled after the Stanford program. And we have a couple of Stanford graduates who've encouraged us to set it up. So I said, well, I'll have a look. I went to the University of Texas as an undergraduate. I have lots of friends. My ex-wife went to Yale. I have, you know, daughter and a son who went to Stanford. I'm familiar with people who went to the, you know, these other fine universities. But the great thing about the University of Texas, it is of such a scale that there is nothing that someone at the University of Texas is not an expert in. There's nothing that somebody doesn't teach. And so the breadth of what you can do. And you can think of the Tower Fellows as you basically take a year, you study, and what do you study? And the answer is whatever the heck you want. And what the Tower Fellows have been really good at is getting us into literally, I would say, 99.99% success rate of any class you want to get into, graduate, undergraduate. If you'll simply persuade the professor you're going to be serious about this. I mean, one of our real estate development guys took a graduate course in the philosophy of the mind. And, you know, he's in there with all these like super geeky philosophers in their ninth year of doing their PhD. And he's never studied philosophy before, but he's a very serious, hardworking guy. And he considers it one of the transformational experiences in his life. I took mariachi music. I never had a music course. I'd never had an art history course. I took history and of modern and contemporary African art, about which the amount I know is infinitesimally small. So I took business in Hollywood. I didn't intend to. I said, the one thing I'm not going to do is take any business, economics, history, or politics courses, because I've spent 8 years in university doing that. But I wandered into the business in Hollywood course, and it was like the most fun course. Elisa Perrin teaches it. And she also runs, you know, an online podcast every Monday evening of visiting experts from Hollywood who come in to talk to her students. It is the most fun course because Hollywood, as we think of it, is in total disruption. Silicon Valley has invaded. Netflix has taken over the world. Amazon has taken over the world. Disney is pivoting to be online. AT&T has bought Warner. Warner's launching HBO Max. So literally, as Elisa said, every day I come to class and I'm rewriting my lecture on the way to class because the whole world changed last night. And you listen to all these people come in and they talk about, oh my God, everything I know is out the window and everything is new. And having the chance to sort of observe a business like that and be involved in it, I'm a film fanatic. I've been to Sundance 10 times, Telluride a half dozen times, the Berlin Film Festival 15 times. So, you know, I spend a lot of time watching films. So the idea that you could study that and study the people behind it was a lot of fun. So where else can you study as broad a range of things as you can at the University of Texas, where you can get a world-class art history professor, business in Hollywood, you can study African art? And the answer is there's only actually one other university, maybe two, and that's University of California at Berkeley in Michigan, where you have public universities that cover the waterfront from business to law to art history to philosophy. They're not as narrow as some of the private universities. They're of a scale where they have lots of faculty And literally, one end of the university doesn't know what the other end is doing. So the Tower Fellows program essentially says, the University of Texas is your oyster. It's up to you to go find what you want to do. But if you want to take Bobby Inman, the ex-head of the National Security Agency's course on international defense and intelligence, go talk to him. And if you can persuade him you're a serious guy, he'll let you in the class. And that's the single most informed person I've ever talked to in my life. So that's why I did it, because I knew from being an undergraduate at UT, the resources of the University of Texas are unmatched. And the chance, one of the hidden secrets, I was in a program called Plan 2. It's the Honors Liberal Arts program. There are about 200 people in it. And you do kind of a two-year curriculum of philosophy, classics, mathematics, science, traditional liberal arts curriculum. You never have a TA. You have all small classes. Many of the best professors in the university come teach there because they get a very high talent pool. But the double secret that made us hated when I was at the university was we got to register before everyone else. So we got first choice of all classes at the University of Texas. So I already had a little sampling of what's out there if you have first choice. And Tower Fellows is kind of like that. Tower Fellows is like, okay, you get first choice of whatever you want to study at the whole university. Just figure out for yourself what to do. And if a year of that is not interesting to you, well, you know, go do something else. Go climb a mountain, you know. But if you like university environment at all, that is the most interesting thing you could possibly do for a year. So I had a great time.
I have to say, it's such an interesting concept. And having had a fellow in my class, I think that it's so helpful on both ends. I don't know what professor would say no, except for the fact that it feels like you're being audited a little bit because you've got these extremely smart, accomplished people that have all this experience that are now literally auditing your course.
Yeah.
But I think it elevates, it has this effect of elevating all the students in the class a little bit, almost like we're on stage a little bit. So I'm kind of curious to see what happens with the program. And, you know, part of me is like, wow, when you look at the roster of individuals in it, could you guys all just be like one big investment fund or like board of directors? It's like, I think that the program individuals in itself is a resource for the school and for elsewhere. So,
well, I will tell you from knowing people who've been in the Stanford program, it is not run by the development department. But you could do worse than bring a lot of talented people to your school and have them spend a year really enjoying the school and falling in love with it and getting to know each other and forming friendships that they'll have for the rest of their lives. That's never bad for a university. And so, you know, one of the things you hope out of each tranche of the Tower Fellows and across groups is to build relationships of folks that you'll stay in touch with. And, you know, each of us have. I'm not in Austin right now. I'm in Marin County. But when I get to Austin, I try to get together with some of the fellows. And, you know, we had a great year together. The one thing I will say about what professor would turn down a Tower Fellow. So Plan 2 has these seminar classes with only 12 to 14 people. And they're very, very careful. I would say they curate who else would be able to do that. Because the one thing they don't want is somebody in there who will essentially think they already know everything and disrupt the class. And one of the real things you have to do as a fellow is, yeah, you've got 35 years experience and, you know, you ran Boeing or CarMax or whatever you ran, or you were a top lawyer or whatever, but you're just a student. You know, you're here to learn and it's good to have conversations, but you're not there to tell everybody, you know, here's all the stuff I know. You're a student like everybody else. And the person who's a productive member is someone who recognizes that. And that's why in many ways, it's most useful if you step completely out of your zone of comfort where, you know, I mean, what do I know about music? I know nothing about music. I've never learned to play an instrument. You know, the professor was astounded at the depth of my ignorance. Ditto, I thought I've been to millions of art museums, spent a lot of time, and I thought I knew all about Impressionism. You know, and I come up against somebody who really does know about Impressionism. And what I came away with is understanding, what is it that art history is all about? What is it that art historians know that the rest of us don't? And what's the work, the archival work they do going back to understand what science did Picasso know about when Cubism was invented? Exactly at what point was scientific development, and who was he talking to, and what discussions was he having over wine late at night that influenced what came out artistically? And you realize, oh yeah, there's a lot more to this than I knew. And you could say, well, gee, that's overkill, because all you need to do is look at it and you'll know what it is. But there is another whole layer of the social and cultural conversation that's going on there. And, you know, that to me was a world that I was completely unaware of. So it's, you know, they always say you can't teach an old dog new tricks, but if the old dog is willing to learn, you actually can. So, which is great. I mean, it's great to learn a new trick.
That's awesome. You know, I want to, with the experience of the UT Fellow Program, and obviously from your days at CarMax and now working as an angel investor, going forward, the type of, you know, opportunity that you saw with CarMax and the opportunities you see working with as an angel investor, is every industry always ripe for that sort of innovation or disruption?
Oh, no. No. I mean, that's one of the reasons I admire Elon Musk, because clearly the auto industry was not. It could not be disrupted. What he's done is impossible. It can't be done. And I knew it was impossible, which is why I didn't invest. And I tried to persuade my son not to invest. My son's done very well on Tesla. So the movie theater business, I would say that's almost impossible to disrupt because it's so dependent on real estate. And yet along comes somebody from an angle, Netflix, and they disrupt it, but in a way that the movie guys never saw coming. So not every industry is capable of being disrupted. But the one thing you always have to do is you have to kind of be like a Texas Ranger out on the plains. I've just finished re-listening to Lonesome Dove. It's a very comforting book to me. I say Southerners in their mind have Gone with the Wind running in their head, and Texans in their mind have Lonesome Dove running in their head. So, but if you're out on the prairie and the Comanches are out there one way and the Apaches in another way, you need to develop multiple vision. And that's what you need to do in business, is realize that even though it looks like your business can't be disrupted, you need to always be watching the horizon for something that you just don't believe is possible. Because I will tell you, Toyota, General Motors, Honda, nobody thought that it was possible for a new manufacturer to enter the auto business and be successful. And not only has Tesla done so, they have become one of the leading luxury car manufacturers in the world in an incredibly small amount of time. And oh, by the way, in his spare time, Elon Musk launched a space exploration company that's now the leading launcher. So, you know, this is an above average guy. Yeah, you know, but so watch out. I mean, the other thing you do watch out for, I remember at CarMax, one of the things I always told people when they ask, who are you worried about? I said, I'm worried about Walmart, because Walmart understands selling stuff to people. They're bigger than God. They have the money to do whatever they want. And if they decided that they wanted to disrupt our business, they could. They're smart enough to know that our business doesn't fit well with their business. And it's, you know, it's a lot easier to disrupt Best Buy or other people. But you want to watch everything. And so Walmart did a little experiment with a local auto retailer in Houston. And we knew how many cars they were selling every day before Walmart knew and before the auto dealer knew. I mean, we had somebody there every day checking every car to understand. Same thing with Costco. I mean, Costco, I think, is the most frightening retail organization on earth, because they are so good at what they do. And so one of the things you want to do is know who could be a disruptor. You know, if you're in the tech world, the answer is Google, 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 and Google. You know, it's like Microsoft. I mean, if Google decides they're interested in your business, that is not good news. Now, they're gigantic, and there are lots of things they can't do, but, you know, they may buy somebody very clever. So it's Internet businesses and online businesses may in some way be more disruptible until they get to scale. But that's a lot of, I guess what I'm really saying. So if I have a skill, or at least had a skill at one time in my career, I would say it was the analysis of competitive economics and competitive market environments. And I worked for the Boston Consulting Group for 3 or 4 years. And that's kind of like a postgraduate degree in applied microeconomics and competitive behavior. And I was lucky enough to work in London, where I got to work in Norway, Germany, Spain, all over the place with lots of different kinds of businesses. And one of the things it gave me was some nuanced ability to look at different industries and have a sense of how might competition evolve here. And that's one of the things you're always trying to do. One of the reasons I stay fairly narrow is I have no idea how competition evolves in biotech. You know, I don't know anything about it. I know a fair amount about consumer businesses that require, that sell big stuff and require lots of people spread all over the country and use the internet. And the thing you look for in investing is you would like a business that has what in the business world we call a moat. That is, once you get to a certain scale, you have made it not worthwhile for someone to attack you. And smart folks look at businesses and say, gee, the cost of winning is higher than the value of winning. And that's what you really want to do is build that moat that say, you know, I could attack, but I'd lose 100,000 troops for something that's not worth that. So those are the sorts of things you look at. Not every business is disruptible, but to say to yourself you're not disruptible is how you end up on the dust pile of history. We had something I called the good idea shelf, which was things we tried that didn't work. Because the biggest enemy of large companies like General Motors is we tried that and it didn't work. And the answer is, was it really a bad idea or you just couldn't make it work? Because we had some ideas that we knew were great ideas. We just couldn't figure out how to make them work. But you need to put that on the shelf and come back to it, because if you don't, somebody else will go to your good idea shelf, take your good idea, and then pound you over the head with it. So the things that can't be done are the things that kill you. And, you know, that's why Tesla is one of the most ridiculously valuable companies on earth, because they did the thing that couldn't be done. And that's what you have to be on the lookout for. That's why you have to have the sort of long eyes for the horizon. You know, look for the smoke signals over the horizon that say, I there's something to worry about over there. I better ride over there and investigate. I don't want to wait till it comes to me. And B, I better be ready.
Sort of paraphrase, only the paranoid survive.
Only, well, yes. And even the paranoid sometimes don't survive. You know, paranoia alone is not enough. So
we're all going to leave here and terrified.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Well, look, there's a reason. There's a reason that I retired in 2006. I mean, if you're in an entrepreneurial business and a competitive business, if you're not losing sleep at night, you're the wrong person. I mean, it's a business you should be losing sleep over, because somebody is always, the more successful you've been, the more young folks are out there looking at, boy, what a bozo of a business. And I bet I could do that better. And there's nothing more dangerous than a bunch of young people thinking about how to do your business better than you do it, you know. So
one of the fun questions we like to ask is, in terms of your career, who would you think as being one of the most influential people, not in terms of not related to you, like not your family circle?
Sure. So one of the most influential is a guy named Bill Donaldson. He was the founding dean at the Yale School of Management. Prior to that, he had founded the first new investment bank on Wall Street in 50 years, called Donaldson, Lufkin, Jenrette. It eventually became part of First Boston Swiss. But after that, he went to Washington. He was Assistant Secretary of State. And then he founded the Yale School of Management. You have to understand, Yale had the opportunity to take the money that Harvard used for Harvard Business School. And the people at Yale said, well, commercial sciences are not a worthy study for a great university. We don't want to do that. So they turned it down. And there was this historic prejudice against anything to do with business at Yale. And to have a guy come in and successfully persuade the university to not only launch this school, but help it become successful was extraordinary. And after that, he rescued Aetna. And after that, he went to the SEC and ran the SEC, even though he's a Republican and ran for Republican governor of New York for President Obama. So it's kind of, Bill's view was entrepreneurship is where you find it. Public sector, private sector, they're entrepreneurs are people who go in and change the status quo for the better. And so he was a huge influence on me. He's just written a book. He's, I guess, retired. But, you know, the guy has had five or six incredibly successful careers. My old boss at Marriott Corporation, Bill Tiefel, who just retired as chairman of CarMax, was someone from the complete opposite end of the spectrum. He worked his entire adult life from his first job as assistant food and beverage manager at Marriott's second hotel up to be president of Marriott's Hotels. And Bill was successful and ended up running the biggest business of Marriott Corporation for the single reason that he didn't want Bill Marriott's job. He didn't want to be CEO. What he wanted to do was make the company work. And what you learn is no company is ever successful without people who want to do a good job at the job they're given and excel at that. And one of the things about the hotel business is anything that can go wrong will go wrong in a hotel. Earthquakes, fires, suicides, war. When a war happens, where are all the reporters? They're at the hotel, they're at the Marriott, because the Marriott has a generator, the Marriott has water, the Marriott has food supplies. So Bill had been through all these things. He was a perfect chairman when he came to CarMax. And after I retired, he led CarMax as chairman through the 2008 financial crisis, because Bill does not get ruffled. Bill had a hotel in Amman during the last Israeli war. Bill has had somebody dive off the 42nd floor of the inside of one of his hotels and splat in the middle of a New Year party. I mean, just every hurricanes, everything you can imagine. And this is a guy that doesn't get flustered. And one of the things you realize is it's really good to have a partner who's seen the worst that can happen. And when all the yogurt hits the fan, can say, look, do our jobs. We're going to get through this. And so, you know, that's a whole other dimension from Bill Donaldson. But the best decision I ever made was to have Bill Tiefel come in and be chairman of CarMax, because it made me feel very comfortable that when I retired, there was a chairman, not a CEO, but a chairman who was a good partner to my successor. So those are two of the most influential people. I mean, there are lots of professors and guys I worked with at BCG and, you know, other business people. But those two guys, I think, you know, were real mentors to me in different ways.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we've all learned so much in this conversation with you.
Well, you know what they say about free advice. It's worth what you paid for it. But
I'll send you a Starbucks gift card.
There you go. Exactly.
Oh, yeah. Because in virtual now, that's what we're doing, right? Is instead of someone saying, oh, can I pick your brain for coffee, you send them a Starbucks gift card to really, you know, make it worth their time.
There you go.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's I'm one of these people who comes from the old school of time value of money. And the idea of giving Starbucks my money so they can hold on to it and have it for free while I wait for somebody to use it or not use it. It's like, I'd rather just send them the money. You know, I don't want to send it. It's like Howard Schultz has enough money already.
Yeah. The whole gift card is a whole other model. Interesting model.
Yeah, no. And believe me, it works famously. Circuit City used to sell gift cards, and they were great business, but, anyway, yeah, you can send me a Starbucks gift card. That'd be great.
And listeners, everybody can send Austin gift cards for this episode. But
seriously,
I'm just curious. There you go. Now, you see me drinking green tea today. My wife is a Dragonwell Lungching green tea. She took a course and became literally qualified to be a master of tea tasting.
Wow.
And she was able to identify 100 teas by taste, 100% correct. So, you know, she's a wizard.
Wow.
And she's persuaded me this one tea is the one I should drink. But most of my folks I've ever worked with, if I don't have a cup of coffee in my hand, they say, well, that's not really Austin. That's somebody else, you know. So I'll always take a Starbucks.
Nice. I'm just wondering, Austin, just as we close the episode, any advice for the business leaders, entrepreneurs that are listening? We're ending a year, you know, going into a new one. Any advice you can give them that you haven't offered so far? I think there's been a lot of takeaways here, but any closing thoughts?
Well, I've never known an entrepreneur who isn't an optimist. I mean, I would never invest in anybody who wasn't an optimist, because the world, you know, the world tells you plenty of no. And I'm very optimistic about, you know, is 2020 the year that my mother used to tell me about what 1941 was like? You know, the Japanese invaded, everybody went off to war, you know, our school closed down, they put in rationing, we couldn't get any meat, et cetera, et cetera. But I mean, 2020 is going to be the year that we tell our children and great-grandchildren about. And yet I'm super optimistic about what we will have learned from this And the upside from it, I mean, in a prior life before I became a businessman, I was an economist. And I will tell you, the field of economics has been revolutionized by the things that we've had to do over the last year. Because as John Maynard Keynes said, we know what we should do. We just never are willing to do it except in war. And in essence, we've kind of had a war that wasn't a war. And so we've had to try some things that we're never willing to try. And I think we've learned some things that actually will be very useful for us. So I'm very optimistic about the future. It's not over yet. And I think people need to be very thoughtful. But, you know, we got some news about a Pfizer Corporation believes they have a vaccine that really works. And I know some folks there at senior levels in research, and I know that they're very cautious. They don't say something like that unless they believe it. They're scientists. So I'm very optimistic that, you know, we may finally get to the point where we can all sit down together sometime and have coffee rather than on Zoom. And that, you know, the next couple of years are going to be great years. So I, as a business person, I think this is a very exciting time. I will betray my political beliefs to say that, yeah, I was dancing in the street for the last couple of days. So, you know, and I think having a return to some degree of normalcy in the world so that I don't have to be explaining to all my friends and relatives overseas. I've been married twice. Both people I've been married to are from overseas. I have lots of friends and relatives overseas. I have a daughter who lives in Africa, another daughter married to a Venezuelan. You know, I spend a lot of time apologizing for the United States and explaining how our politics have gone offline. And I think people are worried about us. And I think they're greatly relieved to think, okay, we might go back to normal. And, you know, I realize that there are many people who support the outgoing administration, but it'll be a great relief and a sigh of relief to the world to be able to say, well, let's go back to normal for a while. So I'm also very optimistic about that, that if you study history, you know that people say, oh, we're more divided than we ever were. It just means you didn't study history. I mean, politics in the United States is a full contact sport and always has been since Thomas Jefferson. And anybody who tells you different hasn't looked into it. But I think we're all ready for a sigh of relief. And it creates great business opportunities when you have a more predictable environment. So anyway, I'm a big optimist.
I think that was a great way to end the segment. So thank you so much for all your time. I think we could all sending consulting tenant donations to Austin afterwards.
Yeah. Or better yet, if you live in California, send me a Pete's card because I really like Pete's
too.
Coffee.
There you go. And coffee bean, actually.
That's good coffee, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your time and energy.
Thank you.
And we will see you on the next episode, everybody.
Thanks for listening to the School of Influence podcast. Amanda and Neil would be honored if you spend a minute to write a review wherever you are listening to this podcast to help expose these interviews to a broader audience. Make sure you hit the subscribe button so you don't miss out on future episodes. Even better, build your influence and ours by sharing this podcast on your favorite social media with hashtag School of Influence. We would love to hear from and engage with you.